Please welcome our first speaker, Carrie, who will speak for 15 minutes. Kim, our timekeeper, will give Carrie a time warning at 8 minutes and then again at 13 minutes. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. I'm Carrie, compulsive overeater, restrictor, bulimic, and very happy to be here with you all. So I will, for today's share, follow the format of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to challenge myself to focus a little bit more on the restriction aspect of this disease. I am someone that identifies with the full range and spectrum of this disease and all the eating behaviors, and I've done them all many, many, many times. However, I think sometimes I'm a little bit less readily available or just not as open to talking about the restriction piece and how that has shown up in my life and how it still shows up. So I'm going to try to focus a little bit more on that today. So essentially what it was like, I think I was born with this disease. I think from a very young age, I used food to self-soothe. And that was kind of the only tool that I had. All that I know that is food tasted good and I liked it and I wanted more of it. And it just lit up my brain and provided me with an escape from my world and my reality. I think it was probably when I got into middle school that I had friends and peers around me that were already starting to experiment with things like dieting and trying to make their bodies look different. And that was very appealing to me, especially going through puberty and seeing my body change and not liking the way that it was changing. So I remember almost having like a group of friends that we were experimenting with the dieting and restricting. And what I did notice in myself is that I think just being so focused on that and in my character defects of selfishness and self-centeredness, that was just like something that I got to put all my attention on and the way that my body looked. And I didn't have to feel a lot of the more deeper, complicated feelings that I was very fearful of. When I got into high school and also having had some different forms of trauma happen to me, I discovered bulimia. And that was something that no one taught me how to do. I just remember feeling like I wanted to crawl out of my skin one day after eating a lot of food. And that was a release. It was a physical release. It was an emotional release. And it got me to take back the foods that I wish that I hadn't eaten in those large quantities. So that was something that truthfully worked until it didn't. And I think it wasn't until I got to college that I, you know, was doing a lot more different eating behaviors and in a very different environment than I was when I was at home. And I also just didn't really have the tools, to live life on life's terms. So that is when I noticed myself really getting to a point of, it's almost like I've blocked these memories out. But what I remember was that, I was having hair fall out in the shower and, I didn't know that I was sick and I didn't really know that I had a problem. My eating disorder was always something that was a secret and that I did in secret. I'm going to pause and put my headphones in because I think I have some background noise. Can everyone still hear me okay? Great. Thank you for that. So yeah, I always felt like I was wearing a lot of masks with my eating disorder. And so in some ways I could show up in the world and be functional, right? I was able to go to school and have jobs and have friendships and relationships. However, inside I was suffering a lot. So that was something that I carried with me for many, many years, just sort of that silent suffering. I did get some outside help when I was in my early 20s. And I think that that helped for a little bit. I also remember initially showing up in the rooms of OA, actually in Berkeley. I went to a handful of meetings. I heard people saying words like food addict and sugar addict and binger and restrictor. And that just honestly really, really scared me. I think I was still in so much denial that I just really wasn't ready to hear the message in that way and be in a community where I could get support. My disease is one of isolation, and my disease would love me to just be alone and have a very small life, which is something that I think, especially the restriction, my disease tells me thoughts like, you know, you don't deserve that, or, you know, that, it has to be this way, very tight and rigid. So what was interesting about going to those handful of meetings at Berkeley is I did buy some literature and I kept it hidden under my bed. And sometimes I would read it, and I did discover some of the podcasts. So the message was creeping in little by little. It wasn't until almost a decade later, though, that I was in a place where I was very desperate. I had lost my ability to do the behaviors, thank you, that really, I think, superficially kind of kept my weight from getting so, so low or so, so high. It looked like a lot of just binging, a lot of overeating, an occasional purge. So leaving a very toxic relationship. I also will just put out there that I identify as queer. I think that for me, while I wore a mask in lots of areas of my life, especially with the food, I also for a long time wore that mask of my sexual identity and orientation. So it was a lot of me feeling uncomfortable a lot of the time with very, very little tools. I was very desperate to get help, and I actually knew exactly where I needed to go. And I think that first OA meeting that I went to in San Francisco, like the 2 weeks before, I like circled the block a few times, just like, but what I found that time around, and probably the first time around too, but I just was more in a place to receive it, was so much support and love and community. This was in, I think, February of 2020. So I knew where I was, where I needed to be. And I was so desperate that I really did have the willingness to attend some meetings, to get a sponsor, and to start working the steps, which was an interesting time for us all. I would say I got maybe about a month or two of in-person meetings before we went into lockdown because of the pandemic. However, at least for me, and I know the pandemic was really, really challenging for so many of us in so many ways, for me, it cleared out a lot of distractions. And I am somebody that also identifies as like a garden variety addict. So there are other behaviors and substances that I kind of learned through OA were not serving me. And I slowly had the willingness over many, many since then to put some of those down. So I did a lot of Zoom meetings. I did a lot of virtual events, and I worked the steps. And it was a gift to be able to do that inner work and to find out, you know, what is my concept of a higher power? For me, I'll just say it's anything bigger than myself. So that could be love, light, nature, sitting in silence. I feel like I get a lot of my higher power speaking to me through my fellows or through people in my life that are supportive. So I will also say mine is a story of relapse. I was slipping and sliding in my first year and trying to figure out, like, what is a food plan? How do I feed myself a proper meal and a proper snack? It was helpful for me to get some outside help with that. And I would say that I never left the program, but there was a point when I was about a year in that I was still in the rooms, but just kind of was feeling like I was putting my program a little bit on the back burner and taking a little too long to do my fourth step. So I noticed that when I take too much of a break from writing and literature and doing my step work or whatever I'm working on right now, I'm working on the traditions. If I pause for too long, a lot of the food thoughts and, you know, me wanting to sort of go back to default addict mode, that starts to creep up in a big way. So that relapse was a couple months. It felt like a couple years being in it, but it also was a way for me to learn more about myself. And it's something that gave me the desperation and ultimately the willingness to put down a certain category of food imperfectly that was not serving me. So things that are really helpful for my program are imperfectly being able to turn over my food on a daily basis. And sometimes I don't do it. I try to do it 10 step, and I try to make sure that I get to at least a couple meetings a week and that I'm connecting with others. Again, anything to do contrary action from what my disease wants me to do, which is to like be in isolation and in the food and not connected to anything outside of myself. So I will say for anyone that's struggling in this program, I do think just the message of keep coming back no matter what is really important. You know, you don't have to be abstinent. You don't have to feel like you know what your higher power is or like what the step work is all about. Just keep showing up in whatever way works for you. And everyone here that I've found is really, really supportive. So I know sometimes, again, my disease is like, ooh, they don't want to text with you. They don't want to call you. Anyone, I think, and at least for me now, having had my own sponsee for the last couple years, anytime I get to be outside of myself and be of service to someone else, that is less time for me to be unmonitored in my own brain and left to my own devices. So I will also say that I have experienced a lot of miracles in this program. So some of those miracles are more concrete, tangible changes. And I will say before I was in this program, I was pretty financially unstable. My relationships were honestly a mess. There just was a lot of dishonesty in my life. And I just really wasn't able to take care of myself in very simple ways and then in bigger ways too. And what I found is that, you know, like now I'm able to be a responsible pet owner. I'm able to be in a pretty healthy relationship, which is not easy. I mean, life in program and me now having some longer term abstinence, life is still really challenging every day. What I have learned though is that I actually, when I'm going through stuff, I don't have to hurt myself and I don't have to hurt others. And if I do hurt others, I can reflect on that, take a step back and hopefully make an amends quickly and then move on and not use whatever's going on as a way to unnecessarily punish myself. I will say that the area that I continue to struggle with is movement, and it can be a kind of all or nothing thing. Lately, it's been looking like a lot less, and I think it'd be helpful for me to have something that is a little bit more consistent. But I think that's just like food and just like so many of my things that are unmanageable and I have no control over. I have to just keep talking about it, turning it over to my higher power. But what I will say is that I absolutely have a life that's worth living, and that this program has been so transformational in so many different areas. So I really thank you for attending this event and listening to me. And I look forward to our next speakers and to hearing all of you share today as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Carrie. Okay, please welcome our speaker, Emily, who will speak for 15 minutes. Our timekeeper, Kim, will be giving Emily a warning at 8 minutes and then again at 13 minutes. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Great. Hi, I'm Emily, compulsive eater, sugar addict, and at the very root cause, body image distorter. Hopefully I'm going to share past, present, and future and what works for me with all of you. One of the things that I do is I let God walk in first, which is a new thing for me, which we'll talk about in a second. And what the message I got this morning was no filters. So up front, I'm going to keep my side of the street clean and be very transparent. If I offend anybody or if I make anybody uncomfortable, I truly, truly am sorry. I think this is the way I need to go, and hopefully it will help somebody. I came into program saying that I have a 50-year anniversary with dieting, and it's an anniversary I never wanted to have. It started when I was 12, and the root cause in going through program, I realized, is that I stole my older brother's Playboy magazine from under his bed and opened it and saw these female bodies and took a look at mine and said, I'm a freak. Something is incredibly wrong with my body. I was 12. I didn't share this with anybody. I didn't share this with anybody until I was 62 years old and got my first Brazilian wax and started crying and said to the nice young woman who was doing this service for me, I said, I'm so sorry. I know I'm deformed. I'm really sorry that you have to see this, which is why I haven't come before. And she looked at me and said, what on earth are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, she said, what on earth are you talking about? And so I told her, I just blurted it out to this stranger, gorgeous young woman. And she said, you are not deformed in any way, shape, or form. Are you kidding me? I see female bodies all day long. And I burst into hysterical crying because I realized for 50 years, I had been living under this completely false lie to myself that caused this massive tsunami ripple effect of how I thought about myself and how I treated myself and how I let other people treat me and how I used food. So, every diet. I grew up in a family that my mother, food was love. Food was rewards. I have dogs and I see how interested they are in treats. And I realized that's exactly how I was. That if I was a good girl, I got a treat. And the treat was always something fattening. Name it, I ate it. And I didn't eat just a little bit of it. But when you were so love deprived and you're so and for me, when I thought I was such a freak, any act of kindness, I just gobbled up. So I didn't have a piece of cake. I ate the cake. And if somebody said to me, stop eating, I just waited till they all went to sleep. And then I went back and ate it some more. And miraculously, it was gone. And I had no idea why. So I had no idea how that happened. Then I was also taught, you need to look better. Nobody will love you if you don't look better. So that's when the diets started. And I truly believe that there is not any diet out there that I haven't tried at some point. And I'd be really good. I was such a good little girl. I was so good for 2 days. And if I hit 5 days or a week, I was like, you know, where's my prize? But of course, for perhaps many of you in the room can appreciate, that didn't last. I would lose a bunch of weight, and I feel so good, what would I do? I would reward myself with a cake or with cookies or whatever it be. Everything had a reason for food or not to have food. That's where the control came into. Fast forward to college, it just got even worse. I mean, we would have super, super unhealthy food at 3 o'clock in the morning after we left the bars. This was the 70s. And then we would starve all day long. And it became quite normal. And in full disclosure, this is how incredibly naive and frankly stupid I was. I envied the girls in my dorm who could throw up. I so wanted to do that. I thought if I could do that, my life would be perfect. That's so incredibly ridiculous, your control over your mind and this disease goes. Sexually, I was completely repressed and desperate for male attention. So I would do anything to get a man, and I would let them do anything to me. I was sexually molested by the owner of a camp that I went to, I acted like my father when I was 12. That didn't come out, and the implication of that until I hit program. So what I said for years was that my first rape was in college, which actually that was not the first sexual attack, but I was in such denial and in so much shame. The shame of that, the shame of thinking my body was deformed, set me off into worlds of fear and insecurity that may no little girl ever have in their life. And the ripple effect went into friendships, went into relationships, went into what I would study, went into how I felt about my worth as an employee, and how grateful I was for and groveling for every little bit of crumb that I could possibly get. The idea of not taking a job that was beneath me, I never even thought of, because I thought, my gosh, what if somebody never gives me another job? I mean, this is how that disease manifested throughout in, you know, it's the water that finds the crack. It's exactly what happened. After my second attack in New York City, where I went to, I started going to therapy. And I've had some amazing therapists who worked really well with what I told them and was very helpful. But nobody, no matter how great they were, thanks, Kim, asked me, how is your relationship with food? How is your relationship with your body? What do you think of yourself? Look in a mirror and tell me what you see. None of that. So the root cause of everything and my problems around this were never fully addressed. It was like we worked around the edges. We never went deep. And that's on me. That was my belief in being in control. My favorite diet that I talked about is going to a hypnotherapist who I thought I had read about and thought, oh, this is great. They're going to change my mind for me. And the constant joke is that I literally would leave his office and there was a bakery below him and I would go and I would spend more money there than I ever would normally do on my own. That was, I have to say, my favorite diet. And that's a joke. So fast forward, this is how I operated in my life. And if a man told me that I looked pretty, I thought they were an idiot. There is not a single mirror. There is not a single storefront with glass that I have gone past that I haven't fully examined how horrible I look and what is wrong with my body. There's not a single person that has ever walked by me that my first thought wasn't something about their body. That was such a projection of me. I remember looking at a woman who was stunningly gorgeous, and I felt complete relief, full disclosure, complete relief because she had a chipped fingernail. That's how absolutely distorted my brain was. So fast forward to 3.5 years ago, since I've divorced and I started online dating, that's a whole other story of what it's like to be online dating at 58, 59 years old and hating your body and being afraid of what you were like sexually. And I met a man who is in another 12-step program. And I have to break and say that I was completely lacking in any kind of spirituality until 2014, when I went through an intensive therapy program and my spirit guide came out in all her full glory. And I went, oh, okay, there might be something here with this spirituality thing. Okay. So fast forward to 3.5 years ago, I meet this incredible man in a 12-step program who has been sober for 26 years, and he introduced me to God. And through that, I was introduced to OA. And I walked into my very first OA meeting, I listened to the shares, and I came home and said, my entire life, I have said that I am a fish out of water. And what I realized tonight is that I'm not a fish out of water. It's that I'm a fish that's been looking for her school. And I have finally found my school of fish. And that opened me up like there was no tomorrow. And I learned all about all of this. I learned about what people have said in the room about the double disease of anorexia or bulimia with the overeating. I've learned that I'm not the freak that I thought I was, that all of so much of my bad behavior and my hatred of myself was very sadly to me shared by so many others. What changed me dramatically was when OA brought out the book, Body Image, Relationships, and Sexuality. That, more than anything in my entire life, completely made me examine who I am and what's happened in my life. It was a physical opening of my soul to examine everything that was going on and put all of the pieces together. I would never, ever have been able to create the jigsaw puzzle of my 66 years on this planet without that book. It was so important to me, and I thought so powerful. And the shares in the room were extraordinary and heartbreaking and understandable that I started a meeting based off of that with others because I thought it was such a powerful book. And I will say, as somebody who has been sexually attacked several times in her life, one of the most important pieces and moments in my life is sitting in a meeting about this book and hearing men share their stories, number one, and number two, having men reach out to me, the enemy, the people who attacked me, having men in this room reach out to me with love and understanding and support. There is not a therapy, there is not a diet, there is not anything that would be as powerful and significant as that. So now, what can I do? When my partner says, you're gorgeous and you have a gorgeous body, I can, with full authenticity, say, I'm so glad you think that. I no longer have to say, are you kidding? Like, what about this? And what about this? And geez, you're blonde. We need to go get you glasses. I don't have to do that anymore. I've had to explain to him that I'm never going to see what he sees, and he has to accept that. As I say, I do hope that one day they will stop making mirrors. Thank you, Kim. And that they will create storefront glass that you can't see yourself in. That would be really, that's a fervent hope of mine. I no longer judge every single person that walks by me. That's because of program. What has been super helpful in addition to this book and what has kept me abstinent and has kept me from hating myself on a minute-by-minute basis, as I mentioned, body image, relationships, and sexuality. It is my Bible. Finding an amazing sponsor who understands me and who understands that I've done a lot of work on myself, and that has to be incorporated in my step work. And she was gave me that wide berth. She gave me the berth of saying, I'm not quite sure what I want my abstinence to be, and to be able to work through that. She helped me understand where I was trying to exert control. In fact, that was part of my abstinence problem. For me, saying that I wasn't going to eat sugar was just one more diet. So how I had to reframe that and rethink and go to God with this and say, what is the difference? What is not the diet? What is it about abstinence? What is it about giving up control? Without her help, I could never, ever have gone through the step works and never gotten to this place in my understanding of my addictions and my self-hatred. Service. I cannot emphasize enough how much service keeps you in this program, keeps you connected to others, keeps you connected to God, keeps you connected to your inner child and your inner being and your soul. As I have said to some of my sponsees, thank you. If there's anything at all that you can do, I highly encourage service. So two more things, and then I will close up. I have a note on my computer at home that says, abstinence is an amends to myself. And more than anything, I would say that grounds me. Because it is. I have so much to say I'm sorry to for myself. I have done so much harm to my body. I have manipulated it. I have cut it. I have tortured it. And the fact that it's still on 2 feet is God's gift to me. I also, as I said earlier, say, let God walk in first. Lastly, I would say, please feel the love in the room. Love heals. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Emily. Please welcome our speaker, Kendra, who will speak for 15 minutes. Kim, our timekeeper, will give Kendra a time warning at 6 minutes and then at 13 minutes. Welcome, Kendra.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for having me. I'm Kendra. I'm a recovering anorexic, bulimic, and compulsive exerciser. And I am going to take a pause to invite my higher power into this space. And I do that because it helps to remind me that this is not about me. This recovery that I have that I'm going to share with you all, it was a gift that was given, and a gift that was given not to be hoarded or stowed away, but for my hands to be open and for my voice to be open and to share. So I'm 25 years old. I came into OA in January of 2021. And I had zero expectations of recovery when I came in. I didn't think that recovery was a possibility for me. I'd completely given up on the idea that it was. I'd spent quite a few years in different levels of treatment for my eating disorder. After going away to school, I came back and was dealing with my eating disorder and other mental health issues. And because those methods of treatment didn't work, I took that as I was unable to recover. There was something wrong with me. It wasn't that anything that like the treatment programs or centers were doing wrong. It was me that was inherently wrong. And I dealt with the shame over not being able to recover because I couldn't get out of the people pleasing. I'm going to do whatever I'm told to do. And then when I'm on my own, I'm going to revert. And is that ties into a lot of where I came from. I'm the youngest of two kids. And in my family, we weren't, the way that love was expressed was very, you had to read between the lines to see it or to feel it, or and it was also very confusing because my father was a preacher. However, he was the only one in our family that was allowed to express emotion. And whenever he did, it was usually anger. And I became really good at dodging that anger, at dodging any kind of confrontation or conflict. And I assumed the role of peacekeeper, of people pleaser, of fixer, manager, and wanted to stay as unproblematic as I could. And for me, the less that I could be seen, the less that I was going to come into conflict with anybody or anything. And I kept my head down. I was a straight A student in school, prided myself on that, and dealt with a loneliness that I couldn't express. Because even though like my family life, my home life wasn't the best, our public life was very much maintained. And there was an expectation of how you present yourself in public and in different spaces. And from that, I learned how to stuff my emotions, how to stuff my experiences. And I never learned how to express those things, express my emotions, express my experiences. And denial became like my world. And so as I was, I guess as I was in high school and up until like senior year, I was exercising like crazy. I had one of those 24-hour memberships where I was abusing it at all hours of the night. When I did leave for college, I was adamant about not gaining the freshman 15, and did the opposite and lost the freshman 15 and felt really good about that and got a lot of really positive feedback about that and kudos and pats on the back and envy. And I was working at a mall, and on 12-hour shifts, I was drinking carrot juice for my lunch break and walking laps around the mall. I was running in the middle of the night, throwing up in neighbors' yards, passing out, getting up and returning home like everything was fine. I was pharmacy hopping and shopping for laxatives and not wanting my presence to be remembered at any of them, so being very intentional about where I hit and when. There was a lot of control managing and no energy really in my life for any kind of relationships or any kind of actual life. It was all maintained by my head. And so when I was diagnosed with an eating disorder, I was in denial about that. I didn't see how what I was doing was different from what anybody around me was doing. I didn't see the problem. I actually felt like I was doing what was right for myself, so that I could go back to school and get back into the swing of things with my peers. And I also held a lot of shame for when I did leave school and watching my peers continue on their, thank you, Kim, I see that. Watching my peers continue their journeys. And even though I was told, like, you know, everybody has their own path, you know, there's not just one conventional way to life. I was hearing that, but I wasn't feeling that. And so I was holding on to the shame of not being where I felt I was supposed to be. And when I was discharged from my last eating disorder center, it was July of 2020. And between myself and my treatment team, we'd recognized that I was regressing in my disorder. However, like continuing in the cycle of being sent up levels of care and back down and up and down, like just wasn't going to be sustainable. And I resigned to just a slow suicide, basically, of like, this isn't going to get better. So I've done all I can do. And I also didn't see many people who looked like me, either with eating disorders, recovering from eating disorders. In the years that I spent in treatment, the main people that I encountered in those areas were nurses that looked like me. There was never patients that came from a similar background or had that. And so that all, I also took that as feeling like I was unique or different or unworthy in whatever way. And I'm very grateful. I had a friend that was my roommate in one of these centers, and she encouraged me to try an OA meeting. And it was a special focus meeting for BIPOC individuals, Black and Indigenous people of color. And immediately all of my preconceptions about what recovery was, what an eating disorder was, what life could be, that all began to like morph instantly. And I was attracted to the authenticity that I heard people speaking with, and they weren't being struck down with lightning for doing so. They seemed to be lighter for doing so. And that's what I started to envy. I was so envious of how people could be so real with themselves, about themselves, and with a group of people who maybe were strangers. And because I hadn't encountered something like that before, I was interested in returning. And what started to happen was this slow reclaiming of my own humanity, where I would get on a morning Zoom meeting, and afterwards I would start to feel ready to eat breakfast, where my experience had been like breakfast was the dread of waking up. And I had no desires to run to the toilet to purge. And I started letting myself be seen. When I first started coming, I couldn't keep my camera on for an entire meeting. I'd turn it on and off numerous times. If I put my hand up, I'd put it back down. But the beauty in that is like, none of that mattered. I didn't need to understand what steps or traditions were. I didn't need to understand what any of those aspects meant, because it was the life that I was being attracted to. It was the self that I'd neglected for so long that I felt called to. And I had to let go of my idea that recovery wasn't possible to me, for me. And I started asking myself, like, what if? What if recovery is possible? What if life isn't what it has been? Or what if it doesn't have to be what it's been? And so I like to say that if before OA I was emotionally constipated, then I am now dealing with the emotional runs, because I feel my emotions today, however uncomfortable they may be, because I know that they're not going to take me out. I know that they're not going to hurt me. And today I understand that like my self-perception is incredibly flawed. And I don't necessarily have the visibility to see myself for having been or done enough, but I have fellows who do have that visibility of me and who share that and can help me assume a different perspective and assume one that's outside of myself. And so I relate to that as my higher power as well. I've also heard in meetings the concept of a higher presence and higher purpose. And both of those also help me detach from the ideas of higher power that maybe, thank you, I see that, tied to a God or the God of my understanding growing up. When I think of a higher purpose, I think of everything I don't currently understand today. And I think of what a gift that is to be where I'm at today, and that the work is in showing up and in doing the motions and going through the motions if I need to, but putting the work in, because it's not necessarily about the outcome. At least for me, it's about what you put in, and not necessarily what I've gotten out. But what I've gotten out is a life beyond my imagination. I started doing service in meetings. I started off as a timer, using my voice to interrupt people who were speaking, calling attention to myself in that way got me comfortable doing that outside of program in my life. And I've since returned to school, a different major. I still feel at times shame for not being where some of my peers are in their lives, like already in their careers. And I get to practice being gentle and kind to myself, and getting to be loving to myself. If I'm tired, I take a nap. If I haven't finished an assignment, I don't pull an all-nighter to do it. I let go of the perfectionism of, if I don't do everything right, then everything is going to go wrong. And I've also learned that at the other end of my desires to fix and control everything, I have like this immense grief for everything that I'm not able to fix and control. And this program gives me a space to feel that grief, to acknowledge that it's there. Because if I can't acknowledge that it's there, then it's going to continue making me feel like I'm not enough in any way. And so while my anorexic brain often attempted or would like to reason reality away, my bulimic brain would assist in, if I did swallow an uncomfortable reality or situation, my bulimic brain helped me get out of that. And today I have a different set of tools, which include a phone, a sponsor, meetings, literature. One of my favorite literature readings currently is the For Today reading. And I find just like those little messages to be so impactful, and they resonate throughout my day. The last thing I'll share is I start my days by turning it over to a higher power, because early on in program, I realized that no matter what I accomplished during the day, at the end of the day, I was still feeling like I hadn't done enough. But what turning my day over at the start of the day does for me is it lets me release responsibility for how the day turns out. It frees me to just be a human and experience the day and be grateful for the opportunity to live the day, to be present with the people in my life. And I'm I'm grateful today. And I think I will wrap it up with that. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Kendra.